Hey, welcome to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow by learning new things, getting inspired, and breaking down the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to episode 66, Interview with Eric Cargiolotto. Eric is a designer and co-founder of Office Hours, which is, in their words, a new kind of professional network based upon the belief that good things happen when you help others. In this episode, Eric and I talk about the value of persistence, why failure is a good thing, the sameness in creative fields, and why authenticity is so valuable. Show notes for this episode are available at gwtw.co/66. Are you looking for more tips on how to get your work to work? Sign up for the Curiosity Lab, my weekly email newsletter at thecuriositylab.net or at the bottom of each show's page. Every newsletter is delivered straight to your inbox on Mondays and brings stories and inspiration designed to spark your creativity and curiosity. All right, you ready for this interview with Eric? Take it away, time traveler Chris. Eric, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Why don't you start by introducing yourself and a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, totally. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on here. This is awesome. I'm a designer, and I've worked for about 20 years, just me and my friend working on things, who is conveniently also named Eric. And it makes for some awkward phone calls. Which Eric do you want, the skinny one or the bald one? We started a design studio about, I think, 18 years ago now, and we've worked on a number of different client projects. And then more recently, we've started a project called Office Hours that I think we've worked on for almost 2 years now. So that's kind of our story. Yeah.
Wow. 2 years. Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah. It's, I think I'm starting to realize how quickly these years are going by when I see, like, when the kids come up and it's like, I'm sorry, this is a terrible tangent, but it's kind of weird. Like, it's just watching as we do these things and it doesn't seem like much time is passing, but when the kids come up the stairs and they go, wow, like, they're getting really big. And, you know, like, years go by pretty quick at this rate, it seems.
Yeah. Well, it's probably easier to measure time with people as opposed to projects.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, and I think it does accelerate. Like, when I look back at the projects we worked on, you know, let's say websites we built 6 years ago or what have you, it doesn't feel like they're 6 years old. It's kind of an odd... At some point, I heard that... if you wanted to extend time in your life, what you should do is vary your experiences. So the notion was that anything that you do that becomes a bit of a routine becomes a time warp. Whereas when you go and travel somewhere, that time extends because you're processing so much new information. So like that trip that I took with my family a few years ago to Ontario, when we went into Quebec and all of this sort of thing, there were so many different memories over that course of 3 weeks that it actually occupies a bigger space in my life. But the days in Vancouver when I'm working and it's raining and I follow pretty much the same pattern, you know, like I take the dog out for a walk at 2 o'clock and I pick the kids up from school at 3 o'clock. And those days tend to kind of blur into one another a bit. So I think that's part of the problem, is the work world becomes quite repetitive. So
I first started following you because of your design work that you've been doing for, 18 years, and your authentic and refreshing voice on Twitter, but quickly became enamored with Office Hours. So what is Office Hours, and why did you set out to create it with Eric?
I think part of it is we really like building things. Like, and I like projects where we get to be around for longer too. So on client work, once it ships, often we step back then and we're not involved as much. The initial idea for Office Hours was really simple. I had a lot of design school students who wanted to get industry feedback. And I think everyone in the industry gets these calls of, can I meet with you for coffee for an hour? And I always liked meeting with people, but the amount of coordination became kind of arduous. And it was also at a time when I wouldn't get home until 10 at night most nights. So I kind of felt like a jerk for the fact that I would meet with a 20-year-old who wasn't my child to talk about design for an hour, but then I'd come home to see my kids sleeping, who I didn't have an hour for, and that seemed really kind of crummy. So the thought was, hey, if we could make this simpler and do it on the web, I could help out all kinds of people. Like, I don't mind talking to anybody for 10 minutes and or longer and helping them, but going to a coffee shop and all of the scheduling and stuff was a pain. So that was the first part of it. And yeah, I think like I've personally worked with over 100 people on office hours. And yeah, and every time I kind of feel like I feel good after every session. Like I'm an introvert. I don't like getting out of the house. But this is like, I get to connect with all these different people. More recently, we're trying to build it into a bigger sort of opportunity and collaboration sort of network. And so what we're seeing, the hunch we have, which could be totally a fool's errand, but it's the one that we're on right now, is that in 17 years of being on LinkedIn, I believe it's 17 years, I have never seen one meaningful relationship develop from it. Not one. I get a lot of spam, a lot of people who want to build websites for us. Mm-hmm. Never a meaningful connection. And I think with office hours, what I see is that after you've had this 10-minute talk, you feel like you're more able to, you have a bit of a connection. And so what we're trying to do is take that to the next step where people can help one another find opportunities. And if you have a gig that I need someone to do an information graphic, or I need someone to write some copy, that leveraging that network to find those collaborators. So that's the part we're working on now. And it's really hard. It's a big, big thing to try to take on. So,
well, for sure, because I mean, you look at LinkedIn and who owns LinkedIn, and mm-hmm. the amount of money that they throw at LinkedIn, and yet no meaningful relationships come out of it. So it's almost like a David versus Goliath scenario where you're just this scrappy, small, you know, company saying, we're going to do what LinkedIn can't.
I hope we're going to do what LinkedIn can't. It's like, realistically, the probability of us actually succeeding at this is reasonably low, like statistically low. And so this isn't pessimism. This is just healthy kind of pragmatism, I suppose. I think there's a possibility for us to do this, but a lot of things will have to turn in the right way in order for us to make it happen the way we want. And again, I don't want to sound defeatist about it, but I think it's important to go into these things recognizing how big they are and how ambitious they are. And if it works, that's great. But we have our work cut out for us. So.
What's the hardest obstacle that you have to overcome in finding success with office hours?
I think it's the same obstacle that anyone who makes things struggles with, which is to basically to upset other people's behaviors enough that they'll actually pay attention for a moment. And so I think as any human being right now, you're bombarded by services that claim that they're going to make your life somehow better, or something that you should buy into and subscribe to, or what have you. And so ultimately, there's only so much attention people have, and they're more likely to go to the products and services that they're familiar with. You know, I catch myself doing this. I should be, we've released this new part of Office Hours, which is effectively like a news feed. And I can see what people are posting. And it's quite slow because it's very, very new. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of me posting. It's not a lot of other people yet. But still, my tendency is to go to Facebook and look at what's happening there, because that's what I've done for the past decade. So to change that, even if LinkedIn sucks, people are going to continue to go there because it's where they go. Changing that behavior is going to take some time. And part of that is just our job. We have to find a way to offer more value in that experience so that it's beneficial for people to come to us first and participate in that community. So
one of the things that you do is you tweet a lot, which is great because you're not the president of the United States. And it's also great because at any point you can go back and read what you're thinking about. And it has a lot of depth and value to it. One thread that just struck me as, wow, he went there, was you were talking about what you hoped your kids got from watching you build Office Hours. And it was something to the effect of you wanted them to see the perseverance and persistence more than actual success.
Well, yeah. like Twitter is my opportunity to just say whatever pops in my head, which is sometimes good and sometimes bad. I'm sure I irritate more people than I think with it. But for me, it's kind of fun because you can do these little quips and so on. And I think what that really came back to was that my youngest son in particular, like it's always tough for the younger kid because they battle it out like their peers, but realistically there's a 3-year gap between our kids. Mm-hmm. So we're sprinting back and forth at the local field. We have a field about a block away. And every time my younger son doesn't beat his brother, and he comes close, right? Like he comes really close. Every time he doesn't, he throws himself on the ground and freaks out because he's not winning. And I'm like, dude, if you just kept pushing, at one point you will get past him because the gap is so small. Mm-hmm. But when he gives up like that, it's funny. It's often like a moment before he's going to break through, kind of. And I think failure is inevitable. Like that's something we all have to live with. And I guess what I want them understanding is that success is not guaranteed and success shouldn't be expected. Like in many ways, I think if you're kind of building yourself up to fail most of the time, like if you accept that that's just the probability, and Elon Musk talks about kind of taking on a fatalistic approach. Like if you just acknowledge that you're just probably not going to succeed, there's a certain amount of power that comes out of that. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's like when you asked about what we're facing with office hours, I'd love to say that I could will ourselves to succeed, but I can't. I don't have that sort of power over trends in the market and what other people think and what other people need and what kind of confluence of events comes to let us succeed or fail. What I can do is put in everything I've got and then go, well, if it doesn't work out, at least I was not the weak point in that. So, yeah.
Well, and it's, as a society, we almost worship success over failure, and anyone that fails is, you know, they've been marked to a lot of degrees. What are we missing by not valuing failure more?
Well, I think what we're doing is we're hiding from failure, which I think we all know failure and we tend to believe that if we kind of can avoid it, we will find success, but I don't think it actually works that way. First of all, in your example of the how we sort of revere success, I've met enough successful people now to get the sense, and I don't know this definitively, but I bet on it that a lot of successful people are successful purely out of luck. There are a lot of people who work really hard and do great things that don't hit the success they should have. And you see this in, you know, if you look at the arts in particular, you see plenty of people who are as good as anyone else out there and they don't break through. So it's funny. I have a friend who works in upper management at like a technical school, and her boss read the Steve Jobs bio and came back and decided that the answer to being a better manager was just to be a jerk. Because if it worked for Steve Jobs, it would. So like, I think what we do is we look at successful people and go like, okay, so what did they do? And then we try to copy those behaviors. Like I'll buy that car and I'll be a jerk in the case of Steve Jobs. And I'll, you know, all these different things and all this ephemera, but those are not a recipe for success. And because lightning strikes in such weird ways, I don't think we can necessarily pull out like a formula to create success, but we're always looking for that pattern. So, sorry, I'm really tangenting here because I think this is a really tough one, right? I think if you cozy up to failure, I believe that your probability of success can be increased because you're not allowing your own fantasies to persist necessarily. So, on office hours, what I've witnessed that is both beguiling and quite frustrating is we thought the challenge would be to get advisors to participate. How do we get all these people to share their feedback? What we learned is that finding advisors was not a problem at all. The problem was in getting people to ask advisors questions. Mm. And I think this relates to ego, that if you have to ask, you're acknowledging that maybe you don't know. And in our culture, we don't want anyone to believe that they don't know. Like you never go to an event where the expert on stage goes, I don't know. Like we just don't like saying that. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is we don't know all things. Like it is just not possible to have this depth of knowledge. So I'm trying to change that behavior in myself to go, even the things that I absolutely believe to be true, to be willing to ask that question of where I might be mistaken. And I think that there's a greater probability of growth by accepting one's own fallibility and not letting ego get in the way of personal growth.
Yeah. Well, and what's interesting is you bring up a whole point about going to people that you perceive to know the answers, and people are afraid to ask questions, and they're often afraid to put themselves out there. I teach at a community college down here, and I see it in the students as, why would anyone take time to help me, to answer my questions? And I'm just like, why wouldn't they?
Definitely. It feels so great to have that connection of like, I know where you are and I've seen that problem. This is how I resolved it. And it's not absolute. Like and I think this is a mistake from like whenever we're giving advice is to believe that our situation is the same. I think all you can do is say that this was what I found by running through that set of things, and perhaps that's useful to you, but of course it's going to vary dramatically based on one's personal situation. But I feel great by having someone else use those findings potentially to their own benefit. I worked so hard to figure this stuff out. I'd really like it that someone else benefited from it as well. And knowing that your knowledge could be put to use by someone else, I think is actually quite a kind of great feeling. And so I never have a problem with anyone asking, but I do suffer from the, if I ask that person, do I admit that I'm failing on this level? Like, I think we all feel that. So that's a tough thing to get past.
Yeah. How has office hours changed your life and your work?
I think I'm a little bit more scattered now because we've picked a really hard way of doing this. We have not pursued venture capital, which means that every bit of office hours development has to be paid for by our other efforts. So, we took quite an extreme line on this about 7-8 months ago. We cut our wages in half just to buy more time for office hours, knowing that if I'm taking less out of the company, I have more time to put into making this a possibility. So we still do a fair bit of client work that pays the bills. But then in between that, I'll get, hey, my session isn't working, the microphone's cutting out, or, just people asking different questions and so on. So it's some days it's great because I can really focus and I feel like I'm really making movement. And other days I'm really frustrated because I've done 1,000 things, but not one that really felt like, I know there's a blur of activity, but I don't know what I actually accomplished that day. So I think side projects are wonderful. And whether it is this side project or something else, I think the challenge for most people really is one of, it's just a lot of balls to keep in the air. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be tricky.
For sure. One of the things that I highly value about you is the way that you communicate. And I would actually consider you a role model for speaking truth in a compelling and very direct manner. And there are two blogs recently that you wrote that have really just blown my mind. And one is Seeking Fulfillment Through Intentional Discomfort and The Rise and Fall of the Douche Bro.
Right.
Yeah. And there's so much vulnerability and depth in what you're saying. And the question that I have is, how did you become fearless in the direct way you communicate?
First off, thanks, because I'd love to say that I don't care what people think about the writing, but it really makes me happy when I find that like someone else has read it and found some commonality there. That's really kind of reassuring. I don't think I'm fearless about the writing because there are things that I have posts that I haven't published that I've been concerned about what the ramifications would be of certain ones, like some of the struggles we've gone through and so on. I've one epic post that I almost posted and I kept putting off because I was scared of it. So I'm certainly not fearless. Most of those posts are just as much writing for myself. Like they're a pep talk. Like there's one I wrote recently about slowing down and I'm awful at it. And it's funny, like it's this kind of push pull of like, I get closer to doing what I want to do, but I don't quite get there. So a lot of them are me trying to make sense of things I'm struggling with at a time. And I really like that form of thinking through ideas of writing. I think the Douche Bro article is this one that, so I think when you look at something like how people conduct themselves professionally, it's just this big lie that we bought into. So it's funny, you have, it's this kind of machismo, it's this edifice of like this Gordon Gekko, like I'm going to be the man, and like it's always very masculine, right? Like this idea of like the impervious to failure, the rock solid guy who's going to take on the world kind of thing. And it's just a big load of crap. Like you don't build relationships with people by thinking like that. And you can't work as an island, and no one is, you know, impervious to challenges and so on. But it's funny, like there is this whole idea that professionalism is somehow about your attitude versus your commitment to doing a job well. So like to me, I swear a lot. I've been pretty good with this talk. I haven't sworn that much, I don't think. But in my conversations with clients, we really actually know one another, and I swear a lot and so on. And I'll admit where I just make mistakes because I know that I make mistakes, and I'll own them and I'll try to fix them. But on the flip side, so that may seem from a conventional standpoint to be not professional, but where I believe I bring my professionalism is that if I say that a thing will be done at a certain time or done in a certain way, I'll actually follow through with that. And if it can't be achieved, there's an explanation for it. And I think that article, for example, was just my frustration with this notion that so many of us are compelled to participate in this big lie that we don't have to care about stuff and that we can do whatever we want. And it's all about just what we get for ourselves. And when I say this, what's funny is that even in saying this, I feel like some could say, well, you're just a hippie. Like you just don't, you know, like it's not all kumbaya and feel good and all that, but like it is bullshit. Like, me acting more serious, me putting out more things to brag about my accomplishments, for example, is not building a connection with the people I need to work with so that we both benefit. And it normally isn't about me anyways. It's about what I can help someone else accomplish, that that mutual kind of experience. So I guess that's a big part of my writing is me ranting about things that I feel are just wrong and shouldn't be a certain way. But again, yeah, it's certainly not without fear because a lot of that stuff I read later and go, wow, was that the right thing to say? Or more commonly, I read them and go, yeah, but there's a whole other argument that negates this one. And so often when I seem really emphatic, it's me trying to make an argument that I know is incomplete. And so, yeah, it's I love it as a medium, but I often read these things later and wonder if I would still argue the same point. Mm-hmm.
Why do you think creative professionals are so afraid to be themselves?
I think creative professionals, I think this is generational. So I'm going to speak to, I'm not sure of your age, but I think we're maybe in the same kind of ballpark sort of. I'm 42. No, I'm 43.
Yeah, I'm 38.
Okay. So like close, right? And so, we're of the age where I can't remember my age any longer. My wife will correct me on that. She'll go, no, actually. So I'm a very nerdy person and I was very nerdy growing up. And I don't know if I was attracted to creative things because I was nerdy or if I was more nerdy because I was attracted to creative things. But at the time, you doing those things meant you were kind of often a bit of an outcast. Like you know, my love of, you know, at the time comic books or science fiction or of like really weird stuff. Like in the fourth grade, I would draw logos obsessively. Like I really did. Like I can still find some of this stuff. And, you know, my mom had a clothing company and I would help her design. No, I wouldn't help her. I would design things with the hopes that she would use them. But really, most of it was really awful. My idea was that I was helping her, though. I think at that time, you did those things not because they were cool, but rather because you were compelled to do them. And for quite some time, I worked in a creative part of Vancouver, and creative, I use kind of in quotes. What I started to see that was really kind of disappointing was a uniform that came out of that world. And I think that in the creative world, you have a lot of us are not absolutely convinced of what we're doing. And there's a lot of kind of shakiness around sort of self-esteem and relevance. And are we any good? There's always that, like, is my stuff shit? And no one's telling me that it's not really that good. And so I think what's happened is, as a result of that, I'm kind of mishmashing different ideas together, but
no, you're doing
I
great.
Think there's a uniform, right? Like there's an idea of what a creative person is now. And it's a uniform of sameness. Like it is raw denim. It's this sort of hoodie. It's this sort of haircut. It's this sort of t-shirt. Like there's a look, and it's a real culture of sameness. It is, Maurice Cherry has a great talk, which I've been kind of sharing with everyone lately on, where are all the black designers? And if you watch his talk and you see the spot where he shows the grids of speakers at different conferences or in different publications, it is a sea of sameness. It is a whole bunch of white men. And so I actually don't believe that, especially in the design world, we actually have the diversity we would like to claim we have. I think it's a big lie. I think we don't have the kind of ideological diversity that we could benefit from. So, you know, I don't vote particularly conservative, or I don't vote conservative, but I challenge you to find many designers who do vote conservative, who don't espouse the same values as all the people around them. So, sorry, I think the reason that people aren't standing up more as themselves is they're too worried about what their peers will think. And I think this is a very self-involved industry. And if we want to change it, we have to stop talking to other designers. Like, I don't think you should go to a design conference. I think my kid got into square dancing, and I went to a square dancing event. I know nothing about square dancing. I don't dance. And I was at that thing, and I watched all these people from Oregon, from Washington State, and from BC, who all came together in Langley, BC for this big kind of event and competition. And there were so many different walks of life, and I could look around that room and go, wow, like, I'm sure ideologically I'm vastly different from all of these people. And it felt so great to be in a spot where everybody didn't look the same and have the same ideas. And I think if we want to start expressing ourselves and being more interesting, we can't Instagram our lives. We can't all look perfect. We can't all follow the same script. So You asked a very simple question, and I think I went on a diatribe there, but that's, yeah, something I think about.
But what you're getting at is a lot of the struggle that we all see. You know, we see it everywhere, the battle to be different versus the battle to be the same. And, you know, I think design for the longest time was very different. And then all of a sudden, you see it in web design in particular, everything starts feeling the same, looking the same. You know, people are doing the same patterns, in quotes.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it's just like, you know, how do you fight that? I mean, do we play the Mike Montero card and just say that we're going to fight fascists? You know, and...
Yeah. Yeah, like, it's tricky because some of those patterns are useful patterns. Like
a login button in the upper right of your screen.
I think that's really important. I think, yeah, like, I don't want to search for those things. And I think conventions are things that we need to be mindful of. I don't want you to change how I open my car door unless you make it way better. If you're doing it just out of novelty, that's probably going to irritate me. So I think that's one thing, to see patterns and see conventions that are useful to that person, to who you're building for. But I think there's some utility in asking why more frequently and not being concerned about what others will say, if you can. So I recently listened to a talk with Ricardo Semler, who had some really novel ideas around how to run a business that were very counterintuitive, like no common start times. You pick your office, but we don't know which office you're working out of because we don't want to monitor you. Things were getting stolen out of the supply room, so they just took all the locks off and said, if we have to lock this stuff, we're telling our people we don't trust them. There's a dichotomy here in what we say and what we do. And I loved that way of thinking. And so I guess I would kind of look to the same thing of, what if you take the absolutely opposite view of what everyone else is doing and work from there? So don't start a design studio where all the other design studios are, and don't go for lunch with other designers, and don't, like, at some point it's really useful to get the feedback and go, how do you solve this problem, and to have that community. But at a certain point, maybe you should be reading books on economics or on gardening or anything other than design, just to, I don't think there's anything wrong with following patterns where they're useful. I think what the problem is when you do what everyone else does purely because you're fearful of doing what you actually believe to be right. You're just following a pattern just because it's there. So I don't, for a long time, I argued that people should be building on PCs, not on Macs. And a lot of people told me what a jerk I was and how wrong I was and all of this stuff. And sometimes taking deliberately, like, that's not as challenging of a notion now, but 10 years ago, it was something that upset people. Taking deliberately contrarian notions often helps you find new insights. So.
Well, I remember reading in Originals by Adam Grant, where he wrote about the devil's advocate and how it's not selecting someone who's going to play the devil's advocate. The people that actually believe the opposite way are the ones that actually create the deeper conversations, because they actually believe they are the devil's advocate. They are, they believe everything that they're saying and why it's separate and why it's different. And that's when they actually had more impact.
It's very hard to face those conversations because they make us incredibly uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if you look at, you know, the what's happened in the political landscape in particular in America, like, we have parts of that here, but certainly not to the same level. But even our last provincial election, you see people pick teams. And it's funny that when you pick a team like that, it's almost as though anyone who comes in with a different perspective, somehow it puts your set of ideas at risk almost. Like, there's this tendency to go, I don't know, my wife and I often have this discussion of, like, you know what, if this more socially leaning party comes in, it's not going to ruin all business. And if the more kind of conservative group comes in, you know what, it's not going to put us in the dark ages. Trump may be the outlier in this scenario, right? Like he brings things to whole new extremes. But it's funny to me where, like, it's so easy to fall into rhetoric and to believe only the things that the people around you believe, and to not actively engage in a discussion with someone who does not stand for the same things as you. And to be able to hit the end of that and go, you know, like, I still don't agree with you, but I at least kind of understand your viewpoint a little more. So, yeah, I think if you can seek out those conversations, it's useful. But in all honesty, it's really uncomfortable. And often I just back away from them because I don't want to have a fight all the time.
So. Right. What's one thing you believe about what you do that would surprise someone else?
I don't know if the idea would surprise anyone else relating to me, but I think it's an idea that is contrary to popular kind of opinion. I think work is actually perhaps one of the most meaningful aspects of our lives, that it's not a thing that we have to do to get to our lives, but rather it is one of the most powerful aspects of what we do, and one of the most, I actually, like, I work too much, and that's a problem. But I find it really interesting. It's sort of like a game that's real. And for, as a result, I don't like board games because they seem like a game without consequence. It's not interesting. Mm-hmm. I think more people will agree with me about how interesting work is once we reach a point when we don't need to work. And I think that's coming. Most of the kind of common thinking says we're reaching a point where we just won't need labor the way that we have. So I think at that point, a lot of people find themselves adrift and realize that the work was what gave them a lot of purpose. And I think that because we need a scapegoat, we need to say something in our life. When we're dissatisfied, we want to find something to pin that on. We often pin it on work or a shitty boss or a client who we don't like or any of those sorts of things. And I think in actuality, when that's taken away, we're going to really miss it. And we're going to seek out things to dedicate our lives to. Mm-hmm. Admittedly, some work is much more enjoyable than other types of work. But I see that now with digital workers who, when they get to go work in the garden or like do something physical, like none of us want to dig a ditch. But it's strange that after moving pixels around a screen all day, doing something that's like tangible actually feels quite rewarding. So I think work gets a bad rap, and I think one of these days we're going to figure out that it actually is pretty fun.
Yeah. What are you excited about right now?
I would love to give you a really like smart, intellectual, like thoughtful response. So what I'm excited right now about, my wife and I have been considering moving about 4 hours north of Vancouver to a town. Oddly enough, outside of a town, there's a ski resort. Mm-hmm. I wish it were like a ski town, but it's still kind of a ski resort, but you can ski in and out of your place. You can go hiking. You can go mountain biking right from your doorstep, cross-country skiing, downhill skiing, the works. So I'm pretty excited about that possibility. I've lived in the city for a while now. I think living in a spot where I could go skiing in the morning before working would be really nice. And I also, this is the funniest one because it's totally not me. Where I grew up, the pickup was like, you know how in like the city people lower the car to look like that kind of person, like the kind of 18-year-old who wants to look cool lowers the car? Where I grew up, everyone raised the pickup. Like that, the counterpart there would raise the pickup and they'd have like, I'm sure you've seen these, the mud flaps with the chrome ladies on the back, you know? So I always hated pickups. They were just like the sign of like the people I didn't want to be around. But lately I've been very excited about buying a pickup truck. Putting a big like rooftop tent on it and taking my kids out camping or going with my wife and my kids out camping in places that would be very remote. That really excites me right now. And if you would have asked me 10 years ago if that would ever excite me, I would have said, no way, I'm never leaving the city. But right now that's pretty appealing to me.
I have to ask this question. What's the first song you learned on guitar?
I think it was probably like One by Metallica. Like, nice. And I didn't learn it. Yeah. I learned like the, you know, like you can do the dun, 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 dun.
Right.
But all the blue, 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 I can't do any of that stuff. But yeah, my relationship with the guitar is long and painful. I never have the time to properly commit. So right now I kind of enjoy that I can play a few chords and sort of sing along, but it's really brutal. It's one of the only real true hobbies I have where I know there's no real likelihood of me ever being any good at it.
But there's a satisfaction though when you hit play on a song and you know that you're just nailing it, even though you're probably not, but it feels like you are.
I'm that bad that when I hit the chord that sounds the same, I'm like, yeah, that sounds totally like that. And I do think like what I love about the guitar is that if I'm totally beat, I can pull up the guitar and play it for like 30 minutes just trying to match someone else's song. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that 30 minutes, I feel strangely rejuvenated. And I shouldn't, because I haven't physically changed my setting. I haven't done anything to really, like, I would think it would be the outcome of going for a run or a bike ride. But it seems like the same thing can be achieved just by doing something that isn't on a computer the same way.
Yeah. So final question for you. Why should I move from my Vancouver to your Vancouver?
I don't know your Vancouver very well. I've only seen it from a distance, so I can't definitively say. I think you should move to our Vancouver for 1 year to try it out, just to see what it's like. It's a beautiful city, and it really is a gem. You know, we have ocean, mountains all around, a lot of activity going on in terms of new development and so on. It's the food is really amazing here. Like the diversity of food is unbelievable. Like I can send you to an amazing Buddhist restaurant. If you want sushi, it's on every corner. Like some of the best sushi I've had in my life, I can send you to that place. My wife and I often take our kids out for Korean food, which we're really big fans of. So, and it's cheap. Like the dining here is amazing. And I hate to make it like food is the only thing you'd find here. That's certainly not the case, but it's one of the things I perhaps value the most. So I think for that, like just as an experience, I think it would be interesting just to try it out. I don't think you should probably move here for much more than that. I think the cost of living here for real estate and rent right now is so incredibly prohibitive that I feel like it's a time to maybe look at other places. I think in particular as a creative person, it all depends on what you're looking for. For me, I want enough space to move that I can actually have room to work. And if my kids want to build my kids are working on a thing right now, have you heard of a Lego mock?
No.
Ever heard of this?
No.
It's a Lego my own creation.
Okay.
And this is, I guess like they share these things on YouTube and stuff. Like this is generational. I don't entirely, I never knew of this prior to them showing me, but my older son, Oscar, has this mock that he's been working on and his younger brother has contributed, but he's really the ringleader of this thing or the head of this thing. They get the base plates and they currently have a 2x2 base plate thing. So it's like 4x4 feet that they've built this whole Star Wars world in.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really, and like they've got water and trees and now they've got out their paint set. And like, if they have to do someone in battle getting like blood coming out, they will paint the blood in. It's wow. Really fun. And like for them, like as creative kids, I just want them to have a basement where they could spread this stuff out.
Yeah.
Because they want to make one that's like 10 by 10 feet. Cool. So I think it all depends on what you want, but I think the real problem with this Vancouver for creative people is that it's becoming so expensive that you can't do a pop-up shop. You can't start a small kind of manufacturing business as easily because your industrial space is so costly. Just in terms of paying the rent, I think a lot of people, it's just becoming so severely unaffordable that people are choosing to go to places where they have, I think I value time more than location right now. And that is the problem with this location is it just to survive here, it eats up a lot of time. Mm. So are you thinking about coming here? Is that something you're curious about?
Or? No, I saw you tweeting again, you know, about
right, yeah.
why creative people should move to Vancouver. So it's like there's always... Whenever you say, I live in Vancouver, they're like, oh, you live in Canada? Cool. And right. I'm like, no, yeah. Vancouver, Washington. And yeah. In our town, we have an identity crisis almost about mm-hmm. that whole thing. And it's as long as I've lived here my whole life, you know, it's always like, not Canada, Vancouver, yeah. USA, you know, that sure. kind of thing. But I was just intrigued because it's like, for me, I don't often think about location as much just because right. I've lived here my whole life. But as I get older, I start thinking about what would it be like to live somewhere for 6 months?
Oh, yeah.
You
yeah.
know, and work and do what I do somewhere else for 6 months. And I never really put much thought into it until most recently, actually.
I really love the idea of trying out some different places. This season of Master of None really made me fall in love with
yeah.
the idea of moving to like some small town in Italy that
right.
They managed to get a lot of PR to this. There's one small town in Italy that will pay you to move there because their population is dwindling so dramatically. I think they have about 400 residents. So oh, wow. if you want to live there, they will pay you 2,000 euros to move in. And it's really tricky where, you know, my wife is employed in a job that's important to her. My kids feel great about the school they go to. to uproot that is very difficult. But I feel like if we could go somewhere else for a stretch and come back, it would be really beneficial to all of us. So yeah, you should do it. Just do it. And yeah, I'll live vicariously through your experiences.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for taking time today to being a guest on Getting Work to Work. I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, and I hope we have many more after this.
Awesome. Thanks. I've loved this as well.
That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you to Eric for taking time out of his day to talk with me about the work that he's doing with Office Hours and sharing insights into being better people. And thank you for taking the time to listen to Getting Work to Work. It means so much to me that you're here. Would you be willing to share this podcast with your friends and other creative professionals and entrepreneurs? Subscribe on iTunes and Android devices by clicking the subscription links found at gwtw.co. Keep in touch by sending me an email on chris@chrismartinstudios.com, or you can find me on most social networks. I'm at CM Studios or at GWTW Podcast on Twitter, at Chris Martin Studios on Facebook, and at CM Studios on Instagram. After Eric and I wrapped up our interview, he had a great nugget of wisdom about playing guitar that is perfect for just about any other creative pursuit. Don't worry about sucking when you first start out. Just find a bunch of other people that suck as much as you do and keep at it. Eventually, you'll all get better. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.